Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Emery Price, joined by Chad Bird. Chad, what's going on?
Hey, good morning.
Good
Doing
morning.
good. I've been sort of having some withdrawals, some Torah withdrawals here. Everybody doesn't know it. We had to take a 2 week break here, so it's been like 2 weeks since we've had a chance to dive into Exodus.
It's true. They didn't know because we were a little bit ahead, but now,
We were sneaky. Yeah, we had one in reserve.
yeah, no longer though. No longer the case. But we're back. We are back. And let me do this right out at the front. Me and Chad, before we faked you out, like we just hadn't been talking, and like I just asked him what was going on, and I don't know what's going on because we've been sitting here talking before we did this. But what we were talking about was an event in California, San Diego to be specific. And that's a conference taking place October 19 through 21. Here We Still Stand conference. I'm going to be there. Chad's going to be there. A whole bunch of other people are going to be there. The list is long. You can go over to herewestillstand.org, see that list. Tons and tons of people. If you like this podcast, we're going to be doing this podcast live. It's one of the things we're going to be doing at this event. So you can come hang out, interact with us, watch us do this live. I don't know how interesting that'll be. Some people seem to be interested in that. I don't know. We'll see how it goes. But here's the thing: if you want to go to that, and it's about 60% full, and it's still over 3 months away. There, tickets might get scarce towards the end, but if you want to get some tickets, go over to herewestillstand.org, register yourself, register whoever else you want to bring, type in the code 40OT, and you get 10% off your each ticket, the whole order. So you can get 10% off and come hang out with us just for listening to this. Nobody knows about this code unless you listen to this podcast.
That's
That's
a good deal.
and here's the thing, you guys, what you get with that ticket, you get like multiple breakfasts, lunch, dinners, dessert bars. I mean, like, you get more than the ticket price worth of food with the ticket. You do. Like, you're basically going to San Diego, and you're getting a meal card to eat super good food at a super cheap rate. It's like the conference is free. I mean, you would spend more money than a conference ticket on the food if you were just to buy it. So you should definitely do it. It's going to be a complete blast, and you probably want to celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation. I mean, what better reason to go to California and hang out with a bunch of people? That's it. That's my pitch. Want to see you all there. Come hang out.
Register. We'd love to meet as many of you as we can face to face. It'd be great.
You know what else, Chad?
What
We
else?
were also just talking about how your book drops just a couple of days before that.
It does. It's coming out about mid-October. If you follow me online, Facebook or Twitter, you've probably seen me talk about it a little bit. But if not, or if you read my blog, I include an ad there. But if not, go to Amazon and type in my name, Chad Bird, along with the title Night Driving, and you can read about the book. It's available for pre-order right now, and like I said, it's coming out, I think, around October 12th, something like that. Will be when the actual copies are shipped. But ideally, we'll get as many pre-orders as we can. So yeah, go to Amazon, Night Driving. There's some information there about it. You can also go to my website, chadbird.com, and I've got a couple of endorsements there from some folks who've read it. So you can read those, kind of get an idea as to what it's about, what people think of it. So that'd be great. And I believe Dan has something coming out too,
It's true.
right?
It's true. It's true. It's a book on parables. But don't worry about that. It's New Testament stuff. It's New Testament stuff. But here's the thing, what I'm saying about this is that, like, you can order that book, get that book, bring that book with you. Chad probably signed it from you, and he'd be all embarrassed and be like, but you could do that. Or if you're like, dude, I don't order stuff online or whatever, you could also just come to the conference and just buy the book. So there's just lots of reasons for you to go there. You can go there to get it. You can bring your copy that you pre-ordered and bring it, meet Chad, have him sign that thing too. It'd be great. It'd be great. So
yeah.
Bring it on. All right. Enough of
Let's
that.
Make it happen.
5 minutes in, and we haven't even talked about the Old Testament, so we better do it.
We better move forward. All right. So if you've been listening, then you know that we have spent, I think, two sessions. Anyway, we've been in the what's called the Book of the Covenant, and we're going to finish that up today. It starts after the Ten Commandments. Chapter 21 of Exodus is where that begins, and it goes through chapter 23. So we're going to cover chapter 23 today. So buckle up. Here we go. We got 33 verses to cover, but I don't think we'll have too much trouble. So as you know, if you've been listening, we've discussed all sorts of laws dealing with everything from kind of relationship kind of stuff between a man and woman, husband and wife, parents and children, to more agricultural kind of stuff, all sorts of things anyway that are addressed in the Book of the Covenant that deal with legal matters, kind of everyday practical stuff. And some of this continues in chapter 23. The first 9 verses are legal in character. And by that, I mean not just laws, but they're dealing with kind of the Israelite legal system or judicial system, as we might call it today. And some of these things are what you would expect. I mean, for example, it starts out this way. It says, "You shall not bear a false report. Don't join your hand with a wicked man to be a malicious witness." So don't go around spreading lies. Don't go around spreading gossip, and especially don't go into some kind of legal situation, some kind of court situation, and join hands with a witness who is not telling the truth, but is lying and acting maliciously toward somebody else. And then it kind of continues in the same vein by in verse 2. So here we read, "You shall not follow a multitude in doing evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after a multitude in order to pervert justice." So the general tone here is that what we need in a legal system, and I don't know anybody who's going to disagree with this, is honesty and integrity and forthrightness and a concern for doing what is just, doing what is righteous. So really, there's not a whole lot here in these verses, this at least in the general tone of these verses, that almost anybody is going to disagree with, especially those who are involved in the legal profession in some way.
No, just there's not anything that anyone would disagree with, just a bunch of stuff that we functionally don't
disregard.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yeah. All this is stuff that people agree with, but when it comes right down to it,
they just don't do it.
They just don't do it. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, everybody wants impartial justices. But the truth is, all you have to do is turn on the radio anytime that there's a discussion of, for example, the Supreme Court, who's going to be the nominee for the Supreme Court justice or something like that. It doesn't even have to be the Supreme Court, any nominee for some kind of a judicial seat. And right away, you find out that you got a spectrum right here, right? You got those who lean more to the left, those who lean more to the right, those who are kind of more in between. And so, of course, there's impartiality. It's kind of built into the human nature. There are no impartial judges because they're all 100% human, and they don't check their prejudices and political leanings and moral philosophies and religious ideals and all the stuff that influences us and our decisions at the door. I mean, that just, as long as we're dealing with human judges, we're going to be dealing with, to some extent with impartiality. That's the nature of the beast.
I mean, all of this basically, I mean, so all of this right here is flowing out of, this is sort of a more narrowed down vocational aspect to not bearing false witness, right? It's sort of just saying, which is true of everyone, but then there's also people who have it that their job is literally to not bear false witness, is to tell the truth, to bring out the truth. And so, and we struggle with that. And so I think that when you hear like don't be a bad witness, don't be a shady witness. I also can't, and obviously this is speaking specifically to people like in positions of being a judge, but we tend to all place ourselves in the position of judge and jury and witness, or prosecutor, the whole thing against all kinds of people and our neighbor, and so we've all jacked this up, I feel like, pretty bad.
Yeah, that we all have this tendency to place ourselves in vocations in which God has not placed us, and one of those vocations that we tend to like the most is judge, in which we tend to act with great severity, disregarding the fact that if we were the ones being judged, we would expect mercy, in fact, be angry if we don't receive mercy. But at the same time, when we are judging, we very rarely actually show mercy to someone who really does deserve it.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so it kind of continues along these lines in the rest of this section. One thing I think is interesting is that there's this verse thrown in that kind of that catches you off guard. It's the third verse. It says, "Nor shall you be partial to a poor man in his dispute." I think that's interesting. So it's almost assumed, because they make this explicit, it's almost assumed that there is going to be some sort of partiality to the disenfranchised, to a poor man. So this is calling for a radical equality with regard to justice. So if you tend to want to be partial toward those who are the underdog, the poor man, well then, this is saying, no, you can't do that. This is not a matter of a man's or woman's station, but it's a matter of truth and justice. So even though you might be inclined, say there's a dispute between a rich man and a poor man, you might be inclined to kind of take the way of the poor guy. If it's a matter of truth and justice, well, that's beside the point. Justice is blind, as we often say. So it doesn't matter what kind of socioeconomic status the various defendants in a case are in. What matters is ultimately is the truth. So the fact that the scriptures make that explicit, not to show partiality to a poor man in his dispute, I think is telling. It's calling for this 100% across the board equal justice, no matter where someone's at on the economic level.
Yeah, I think we can see this, I mean, played out practically. Now, the way it typically works is that the rich man has more legal advantages in our current structure, where if you have a bunch of money, you can get better lawyers and more of them, and bribe the right people. This is so there is this, I don't think it's completely wrong to assume this, where if you did have big guy versus little guy, and you think, man, big guy's got a lot of advantages, you know, poor guy's got a, you know, public defender or whatever, and the rich guy's got like an army of lawyers. But to the general public, you know, to someone like me or you, like, we might be like, oh, well, that guy's got a lot of power. This guy's got a lot of money. He's probably wrong.
Yeah, that's our assumption.
And that's incorrect. He might have all the advantages. There's a lot of, we know there's a lot of corruption because we're sinners, and that happens. And so it's easy to go there. And you're probably not wrong that is the case much of the time. But it is wrong to just assume, like, well, this guy is in a position of power and this guy's not. Therefore, he's automatically at fault.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you got that thrown in, and then another interesting part of this, at least I find it interesting, I hope everyone else will too, is that this is really outside the legal system, these next couple of verses, but they're thrown in here as well, because they have to do with how you treat your neighbor. And let me read them to you. It says, "If you meet your enemy's ox," I'm sure that happens to many of us, If you meet your enemy's ox or his donkey wandering away, you shall surely return it to him. If you see the donkey of one who hates you lying helpless under its load, you shall refrain from leaving it to him. You shall surely release it with him. Now, of course, this is not an everyday situation that I think most of us have encountered. I have yet to see the donkey of the guy that hates me lying on the road, helpless under its load. But I certainly have seen plenty of other situations where I'm dealing with someone who does not think kindly of me. Remarkably, there are a few people out there like that. And I'm called in these verses not to let either his hatred of me, or I suppose my hatred of him, or any ill will that he might feel toward me or I toward him, anywhere, I'm not to let any of that influence my desire to assist him when he's caught in a bad situation. The reason I think this is interesting is because this is so insightful into the tendency of human nature. I mean, if there's anybody that we are prone to walk past and not help if they're hurt or if they're in trouble or if they're in need, it's the guy that hates us, right? I mean, why should I care about him? He didn't care about me. In fact, he hates me. So why should I do a single thing out of kindness or concern for him? Well, the reason I should is because that's exactly the way that God acts toward us, right? Even while we were yet enemies of God is when he loved us and died for us. So the attitude and the activity of God toward us and acting in mercy toward us is exemplified here in the activity of the one who actually helps the neighbor who can't stand him.
Yeah,
Whether if his possessions are lost or wandering away, then you return it to him. You don't keep it, or you don't laugh behind his back or whatever it is. So it's a concern for love toward the seemingly unlovable, mercy toward those who don't show mercy to us.
Yeah, this is just Good Samaritan stuff.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is.
Come across your enemy all beat up, and you're like, yeah, you know what? I think I'll just leave you there.
Yeah.
And that's not how it works.
Not how it works, no. So you got that thrown in there. I think the rest of that is kind of going along with what we already talked about. Don't take a bribe. Don't oppress a stranger. Keep far from the false charge. Don't pervert justice. All this kind of talk that is an elaboration of what we've been talking about at the beginning of the chapter. All of which, as Dan pointed out, is an elaboration on the commandment about not bearing false witness against your neighbor. That commandment means that we shouldn't tell lies about a neighbor, betray him, slander him, or hurt his reputation. But it also applies specifically to those occasions where we're an actual witness in a court of law. So it applies across the board, whether we're in a legal system or just in an everyday situation. So that's the first section, the first 9 verses. And then we transition in verse 10, really verses 10 through 19. We deal with a whole other matter, which we haven't talked about in the Book of the Covenant so far. And this is what you might call the kind of Old Testament religious calendar, what some churches would call their liturgical calendar. That is, it's the calendar of festivals, either weekly or annual festivals that the believers followed. Now, we're going to hear a whole lot more about these festivals as we go along, because they're discussed in multiple places in Leviticus, in Numbers, in Deuteronomy, especially in Exodus, Leviticus, and Deuteronomy. So we'll see these over and over. So I'll say a little bit about these as we go through these. You've already heard a little bit about them when we talked about Passover, but they come up again here. So the first few verses, 10 through 13, are concerned with both the Sabbath day as well as what's called the Sabbath or the sabbatical year. So we haven't talked about the sabbatical year yet. But here's the way it works. So verse 10 says that you shall sow your land for 6 years and gather in its yield. So for 6 years, you do like any farmer would do. You plow, you plant, you reap your harvest. You gather it in. Then verse 11 says, but on the seventh year, you shall let it rest and lie fallow, so that the needy of your people may eat. And whatever they leave, the beast of the field may eat. You are to do the same with your vineyard and your olive grove. Now, this is a very, I think, unique, at least to my knowledge. This is a unique Israelite practice injunction in the ancient world. And I've often wondered how often this was actually practiced. Maybe it was practiced, and we're just not told about it. But it certainly is commanded more than once in the Torah. That is that the seventh year is a Sabbath year. There's not to be the farmers basically have the year off, so there's none of the regular planting and harvesting and everything else that takes place in the agricultural world. Instead, the seventh year is a year of rest for the field. And part of the reason for this is that it provides an occasion for the needy of the people, the poor people, to be able basically to gather up whatever grows of its own. I mean, if you harvest a field, if you don't plant it again, there's still going to be wheat or barley or whatever that comes up, because that's just the way it works. You always have seeds that fall off and then that grow on their own the next year without being actually planted by the farmer. So whether it's a vineyard, whether it's an upgrown, whether it's a wheat or barley field, all of these lie fallow the seventh year in order that they may rest the soil, actually, may rejuvenate. That way it's not completely deprived of all its nutrients by year after year after year having the work done in the field. So that's the seventh year. Later on, we'll hear about the Jubilee year, which is actually the kind of an elaboration of this. It's the 50th year, which is also very similar. But this right now is just the seventh year, the Sabbath year. So that has to do with the sabbatical year. And then the next two verses have to do with the Sabbath day, which we've talked about more than once. It's, of course, the commandment about keeping the Sabbath day holy. This is an elaboration of that. 6 days you work, seventh you cease from your labor, in order that your ox and your donkey may rest, as well as your servants and the stranger who is in your midst.
Correct me if I'm wrong before we go, that as we talk about the sabbatical year, so this is obviously your, yes, set aside for the soil and the farmer to rest, but also as a way of provision for the needy, right? So you see again that there's it within Jewish law, there is provisions made for those who have need, for those who are impoverished, this sort of thing, and which is interesting. But I also think that, like, it was also against the law for you to prosecute or stop somebody from, like, picking up stuff that had fallen, like stuff out of the field that had, like, fallen on the ground and things like this, correct? Like, if you had, like, somebody, you know, whatever, if your trees had all this fruit on them and something fell off them and someone picked it up, that was against the law to say, like, that was stealing or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was a if folks remember the story of Ruth, I mean, that's what she was doing in the field. You know, whatever grain was left over, she was picking that up. But, you know, the reapers, whatever, you know, they're always going to drop some of it. So that's what she was going out and was gathering up. So that was, it was supposed to be done in order that the poor might have something to eat, as well as there's language about, like, not harvesting the very corners of your fields, so that a little bit of grain is left standing also for the poor to gather it for themselves. So there was built into the Israel legal system this concern for the poor that not only was it okay that you know, that was not wrong for the poor to do this, it was actually encouraged that those who had the fields, who had the grain, harvest in such a way that they're also looking out for the needs of the poor who didn't have fields of their own to harvest.
Yeah. So it wasn't just a matter of, hey, this is okay if this happens. It would be against the law for you to stop someone from doing it.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's interesting. So on one hand, you see, like, hey, yeah, justice is blind. Don't just because someone's poor doesn't mean they're innocent or whatever. But then so you're like, man, brutal. But then at the same time, there's all these laws that are built in to protect the the livelihood, or the to preserve those who have less.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of our struggle today is, we at least in most countries, we have systems in place that, yes, imperfectly, but at least there's systems in place in order to help those who are impoverished. It doesn't matter if it's with medical help or with food stamps or with food banks or whatever it is. There are systems in place. Governmental systems in place in order to at least provide some care, some food, some clothing, some shelter for those who don't have anything for whatever reason. But that was not in place. It was nothing in place like that in the ancient world. I mean, there was no welfare system whatsoever. And so if you have an orphan, for instance, or if you have a widow or someone who for whatever reason is physically disabled and so cannot work, like someone who's blind or something like that, they were basically at the mercy of their neighbor. There was no governmental assistance program, so anything that the neighbor could do in order to help them was not only allowed but actively encouraged. And that's why very frequently throughout the Old Testament, the people that are singled out as those who are especially in need of help, those who especially are actually prone to being taken advantage of, are the widows and the orphans. Because there is no one to protect them, there is no one to provide for them. They are literally at everyone else's mercy. So this laws like that about leaving grain in your field was one way in which at least their food needs were met.
So I mean, it is interesting, the in our Western society, at least. I only speak from my own experience, but we do have this, you hear this, you hear this all the time come up, right? It'd be like, well, you don't work, you don't eat, which of course Paul says. But at the same time, you have to hold that sort of thing in tension with, hey, you also have, you are also commanded to take care of the poor among you and make sure they get to eat. So you got to deal with the paradox there of, hey, there are those who don't have anything, and you need to make, it's incumbent upon you to make sure that they do. And at the same time saying, like, hey, it's not good to be lazy.
You have to hold those two in tension. And I think as individuals, most of us lean in one direction or the other. I mean, we tend to be the one of those, you don't work, you don't eat, or one of those, hey, we need to do everything we can to take care of the poor. And I think most of us are leaning in one direction or the other. We're kind of caught in that tension.
And I
But,
think, and I think it's also like this. If I was, as I look at those two things, I look at one as sort of like something that might be objectively true. Like, if I decide I'm not gonna do anything, well, there is a chance that I'm not gonna eat if I do that, right? Like, so that's sort of speaking to me is like, hey, I mean, if I don't do anything, I'm probably not gonna like be able to buy anything, and so that's gonna be bad. I then, as someone who like looks, who would look at somebody with nothing, the verse that should be in my head is probably not, if you don't work, you don't eat. That verse should be in my head, if I'm not working.
As applied to you. Not to the other person.
But if I do have things, and then there's this other person that has nothing, the verse in my head should not be, well, if you don't work, you don't eat, man. No, the verse in my head should be like, you need to take care of the impoverished. You need to take care of the widows and orphans. So I think I think we get that twisted around sometimes. Like we want to like switch it up, you know, and like and be like, I'm gonna apply this verse to this person when that I should be applying that verse to me and applying this other verse to them. It's sort of like when dudes come up to you and say, "Give me all the verses about, you know, my wife submitting to me," and you're like, "I don't think that's addressed to you."
Yeah.
That's
That's when you quote the other verse in that section,
yeah.
submit to one another out of reverence for Christ.
Yeah, I'm like, why don't you go read about like all the things said to husbands and worry about that?
Yeah, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church,
Yeah,
right?
so when someone comes up to you, he's like, "Hey, man, I got this deadbeat neighbor. Where's that verse about not working and not eating?" I'm like, "I don't know, but why don't you go worry about the verse that says you need to take care of your neighbor?"
The old Adam always enjoys those verses in which we can use them to make somebody else do something,
Yeah.
make somebody else feel worse.
Yep.
We're experts at deflecting the law away from ourselves and onto someone else. So the next section, 14 through 19, deals with the three main festivals of the Israelite calendar. And like I said, we will be talking about these a lot more as time goes on. So they are here, they're not by different names, but here they're called the Feast of Unleavened Bread, the Feast of the Harvest, and the Feast of the Ingathering. So the Feast of Unleavened Bread, we already talked about earlier in Exodus in connection with Passover. So you have Passover, and then you have a week-long Feast of Unleavened Bread. So that's always the first month in the spring. Here it's called the month of Aviv, literally known by the Babylonian name of the month of Nisan. So that's the first. The second is the Feast of the Harvest, which we know as, it's also called the Feast of Weeks, which in Hebrew would be Sukkot. But it is, we know it as the Feast of Pentecost, so which means 50 days or 50th, which of course was also the day on which the Holy Spirit was poured out on the disciples in Acts chapter 2. So you have I said it was the Feast of Sukkot. Shavuot is what I meant to say, sorry, long word there. Feast of Weeks, Shavuot. The third of these is the Feast of Ingathering, which is also known as Tabernacles. It's the fall festival, which is connected with the fruit gathering time. So those are the three main feasts of the Israelite calendar. You got Passover, Unleavened Bread, and then you got Pentecost, and then you have Tabernacles. So each of these three times, at least all the guys, and a lot of times it wasn't just the men, but it was the families as well. They were to appear before the Lord God, as verse 17 says, and sacrifices would be offered. There were various rituals that built up over time or practiced during these 3 weeks. So those are the three main pilgrimage festivals, which in Hebrew is called a Hag. It's usually spelled Hag or Chag. There's actually a connection, a linguistic connection between that word and another word that you probably have heard, and that is the Arabic word Hajj. So one of the pillars of Islam is that at least once in their life, Muslims are to make a Hajj or a pilgrimage to their holy city of Mecca, which is usually spelled Haj. So, but these two words are related. So a hag in Hebrew or a hajj in Arabic, they both refer to this pilgrimage festival in which you actually journey to a particular holy site and celebrate there. So that's that next section. Just to wrap things up, and I don't know if we'll finish all of it, but this next section, which is 20 through 33, ending up this chapter. We are once again introduced to this so-called angel that is going to journey with Israel. Here's how it starts out. It says, "Behold, I'm going to send an angel before you to guard you along the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Be on your guard before him and obey his voice. Do not be rebellious toward him, for he will not pardon your transgression, since my name is in him." And then it goes on. to talk a little bit more about this angel. So this is kind of a unique section in some of the language that's used about this angel or this messenger, but it actually ties in to where we've seen this angel many other times. We were first introduced to this messenger way back in Genesis. He's the one that encountered Hagar when she was in the wilderness. Then we certainly saw this angel on full display in the burning bush in chapter 3 and 4 when he talked with Moses. And back then we discussed the fact that, first of all, I wish it wasn't translated angel. And the Hebrew there is malach, which just means messenger. So this is the messenger of Yahweh, the one who bears Yahweh's word, the one who speaks for him, who acts for him. And here, the unique language that we heard at the end of verse 21 is that God's name is in him. And I don't think there's any more important verse for understanding who this angel is than this particular verse here. Because for God's name to be in this messenger is for God's identity, for his essence, for his power, for his authority, for all of who God is to be in this messenger. Because that's what name connotes here. For God's name to be in this messenger is for God, and all that God is to be in this messenger. And that's why the whole history of the church, this angel has not been understood to be what we usually think of as an angel, but instead the messenger of Yahweh, that is the Son of the Father. So this is Old Testament language for the Messiah. So he is the messenger of the Father. He has the Father's name in him, that is his power, his authority, his essence. And he is the one who here is journeying with Israel, who's going to guard and protect them along the way and to bring them into the promised land. And what he says, the Father says. What he does, the Father does. When he guards, protects, it's the Father doing it. So as Christ will later say in his incarnation, you know, he who has seen me has seen the Father. So even here back in the Old Testament, when Christ appears as this messenger, he appears as the one who embodies everything that the Father is.
Well, yeah, I think another reason why you know this is the case is that it talks about not resisting him or not rebelling against him, right? Because if you do, he will not pardon your transgressions. Well, angels can't forgive sins.
You know, right.
You know, that's not something that they do.
It's not something angels do.
And so by saying that, like, hey, if you rebel against this person, he, not I, but like he will not pardon your transgressions, sort of infers that if you don't, he will. You know, so
right. Right.
Which means that this is God. So, I mean, like, the Pharisees ain't wrong when they say only God can forgive sins. True enough. You know, so I think you have that. I also think it's interesting that it even says that on the heels of just tons and tons of law. So you have to give you the Ten Commandments, and then you have all of this other law. And then it's like, I'm going to send my messenger, who is my son. Don't turn him away. Don't rebel against him. Don't shun him. He is here, after all, to forgive your breaking of all this law.
Right. Yeah. It's a perfect positioning, right? That's a great way to wrap up the Book of the Covenant. All these laws. And by the way, I'm sending the forgiver into your midst.
Yeah. So don't reject him, because otherwise you will be, this law is going to screw you over for sure. You're going to find yourself coming up on the short end of this. So I'm sending this guy. Don't reject him, because he's going to keep you safe. He's going to protect you. He's going to bring you in. Like, he's going to keep you in right relationship with me. He's going to be the forgiver. And if you push him back, if you rebel against him, well, then you won't have that. And that's a bad place to end up.
Right, right. Yeah, so, I mean, that's a few more verses after that, but that's the major thrust of this last section of the Book of the Covenant. which is perfect. I mean, it's divinely set up that way. You got laws after laws after laws governing society, individual life, judicial system, all this stuff. And then God says, now for the most important thing, I'm sending you my son. He's got my name in him. He's got my power and authority. So don't push him away because he's got everything that you need. He's going to be the one who forgives you and brings you to the land that I prepared for you.
Yes, that is good news, and we are out of time. So we got a bunch of law, but we got some Jesus at the end there, which is good news. So, guys, thanks for hanging out. We will be back next week, and it'll probably be a little bit different, I think, next week for you,
Right.
Chad.
Yeah, we got some good stuff coming up in chapter 24. Got the book of the sacrifice, the book of the covenant, the sprinkle of blood, lots of good stuff coming up.
Right on. All right. Well, we will see you next week.